Leo Freeman never imagined he'd end up as a financial advisor. As a young musician, fresh out of college, he was determined to make it as a professional trumpet player rather than take a soulless corporate job. However, the reality of needing health insurance and a steady income eventually led Leo to a position as an executive assistant at an investment advisory firm. What he discovered there laid the groundwork for an unexpected career pivot that aligned their values with their work. Listen to the full episode to hear their story. Leo is a thinker and a tinkerer with a musician's brain and an activist heart. For the past 8 years, Leo has worked inside of the financial services industrial complex as an advisor, learning the master's tools, then as a social justice financial advisor with Adesina Social Capital, wielding the master's tools in service of social justice movements, and most recently as a director of fund development with Seed Commons, building new tools to channel non-extractive capital to community. A passionate advocate for intersectional justice, Leo brings a systems approach to his work with philanthropic organizations, institutional and individual investors, and financial advisors. Leo is a founding member and an inaugural steering crew member of the Radical Planners community, a co-creator of Capital J Collective, a co-director of Redefine, and a member of Transformative 25 Committee. Leo is not big on academia, but he does hold a few degrees from CSU Sacramento in jazz performance and pedagogy. He is an accredited investment fiduciary and holds a Series 65 license. Leo lives in Berkeley with their dog, Friend. Leo is an anti-capitalist, abolitionist, vegan, feminist, activist, non-Zionist, anarcho-utopianist who reads a ton of queer theory and liberation literature and is focused on building and deepening community relationships and dreaming the world to come. Welcome, Leo. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. I'm so excited to have you here at Highly Sensitive Money. And Leo and I know each other. We met before we actually met. We met through Adesina, and then we met again at the Morningstar conference where I was part of a panel with a mutual friend with Fong. And you invited me to Rad Planners, where financial planners become activists and activists become financial planners. And we build a new solidarity economy, hopefully in the process, in the middle of it. So it's such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me. And I forgot that we met at the Morningstar conference. I think I tracked you down to the lunch line, to be clear. It wasn't just your panel. But after your panel, I stalked you a little bit and made sure that you were gonna hear me out about Rad Planners, which Fong was a part of people forming it. So
yeah, and it's been such a part of me continuing to stay in this work and like envisioning. Because, I mean, the work that we're doing at Rad Planners is what Adrienne Marie Brown called science fiction. You're just creating a whole new way of being. And it's good. I mean, we need other people to be there with us because there's so much. The status quo is so strong in financial services.
Yeah.
So I want us to start off with the highly sensitive piece of this podcast. Like, how did you find out about HSPs? How do you identify with it? And how do you see it reflect in your money work?
Yeah, great question. And I just bit on the science fiction thing. I've really been thinking so much about that quote, that Adrienne Marie Brown quote, and thinking about how, so much of what we're doing is world building. And like, that's how I've always related to sci-fi and like Octavia Butler, and thinking about like, as we go through and like, we're building something together, it's kind of this like imagining and dreaming other worlds that are possible or another world that is possible. And so a lot of that kind of, you know, dovetailing into the question around like HSP and neurodivergence and that some of the identities that I hold, my roots, I think, around HSP as a highly sensitive person, someone who I have not identified as an HSP for a very long time, but I think I notice in many of my identities, especially marginalized identities, I found myself over the course of my life being in community with folks before I really knew that I like was one. So I was always like looking around myself and I was like, oh, why do I have so many queer friends? And I'm like, I'm just number one ally. And then one day I was like, oh, right. No, I'm like really queer. And then same thing with trans identity. Like as I just like had a lot of trans friends and a lot of people with like, you know, in the early aughts, like with pronouns. And then one day I was like, oh no, like I'm really trans. And a big part of that, I think, was also coming into like my identities around autism and ADHD, which, you know, as someone who I think has historically, you know, I have like an adult diagnosis of autism, but I've known that I have ADD since I was a kid. So I think some of these like aspects around like emotions and sensitivities for me were really just that I was really hyper aware of other people's emotions. And I can talk more about like, you know, some codependency recovery and working the 12 steps of CODA, which was like historically getting there in recovery was so much about like getting in touch with my emotions and feeling feelings. And as a highly sensitive person, like feeling my feelings was really hard and really scary and like heavy. And also was the thing that helped me get to understand, yeah, basically like so many of my identities, and is now the sort of like emotional sobriety that I have now and I'm able to sort of carry, is the thing that allows me to sort of move. I think especially in like, so in social justice work, like I think it allows me to actually go to the depths of like, how do I actually connect with, for example, you know, the war in Israel and occupied Palestine, like my grief, and not just like suppressing my grief and letting it come out as rage, or holding grief and joy and rage all simultaneously, being able to be emotionally sober and connect with my emotions is something that has really allowed me to engage with social justice in a way that was like, you know, less fragile and less reactionary and more like rooted and grounded. So I think I got all your your questions woven in there.
Yeah. Because that is when I first started hearing about HSPs, I was like, sensitivity, no, not me. Like, let me numb. That was definitely my MO. Like, no, I want to numb. Because it felt so strong. And I've talked about it before that I wouldn't be able to do social justice work, especially in money, if I weren't held by places like Red Planners, by places like my Quaker community, by places that have like, that are just, that can hold it, because it's so complex and such a paradox.
Yeah. Mm. I love that word, paradox. I've been reading Post-Capitalist Philanthropy, and they're, you know, sort of going through all the paradoxes of wealth and power. And like, for me, a paradox is super helpful because it helps me kind of understand like, this is the right side up world and here's the upside down world. And there's like the I think especially with like numbing, for me, I've always been, I think historically when I was moving into recovery, I thought like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. And then I was like, oh no, I'm like addicted to working out. Oh no, I have an eating disorder. I have all of these things. All of these things can be true, but through the lens of like, actually, what am I solving for? I'm solving for like feeling my feelings, and I'm trying to numb to them and using different like vehicles over the course of my life and people pleasing and sort of controlling for other people's emotions and manipulating people emotionally was like a way that I was controlling to sort of like stay in like a comfort zone. And I think moving to like discomfort, now I kind of can't not, you know, so. Anyway.
Yeah. There's a little bit of like titration that has to happen. It has to be, because I know when I'm working with clients with money coaching, and I see, that's one of the beautiful parts of being HSP for me, is that when I'm doing the work, I can read people so well. And like before, it was just like, I was so scared, so I had to read people to make sure that I was safe. Now I'm like, oh wow, this is such a helpful tool. It's such a helpful skill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that reframe.
And in everything, I have this quote next to me by Jon Kabat-Zinn that says, anything and everything can become our teacher. Mm. Our teacher of the moment. Anything, everything, if it is met in the present moment. Mm. And I'm not out there looking for tools, looking for lessons learned, but like life will hand them to you.
Yeah. Yeah, truly. And I love the framing of like everything and anything and everything. I'm going to toss this. Sorry. Hey, go over there, please. Speaking of highly sensitive, there's this aspect, I think, of like finding your teachers where you are. And yeah, like in the present moment, like listening and paying attention to the things. All right, fine. She's just going to be here. So for me, like, yeah, the turning that into a superpower, and then also looking around you and being like, right, why are some of us so in this space, like, why are there people who are like incredible issue spotters, like financial planners and estate planning attorneys, people who are like meant to kind of come in and spot issues and like read people and like hold people well? It like, well, we can talk more about like how I got into this work and in a sec, I'm sure. But like, yeah, so much of that has been a superpower for me that I historically never, like, you wouldn't sort of on paper see that, like, being, yeah, like attentive and really being able to read people well, especially, yeah, when tracking for safety, historically as a marginalized person, seeing that, being able to read people and understand, and like also the desire to connect, those combined are like actually a superpower versus like, this is a flaw. It's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. Well, and it's the thing about being HSP that I'm learning, cause I'm still like coming to, for me, when I first heard those terms, I was like, no more labels, no more acronyms, you know, like, all of these labels when I was depressed in college, I don't want any more. But now I'm learning, like, it's between 15 to 30% of the population. So it's significant enough, but it's not the majority.
Right.
So it's like, it's easy enough to find my people. And I've realized that that's where I connect a lot. And actually that's one of the things that they recommend, that like when doing this research, they recommend that you spend time with other people that are highly sensitive, because we have the bandwidth for each other. I've started to see how much more processing my close friends need and how much I need, and like learning not to go to people who don't need that processing to ask for processing.
Yes, I love that. I'm like literally taking notes, because every time I talk with you, Deanna, I'm constantly taking notes. I'm always learning from you, speaking of being in the present moment and the teachers. But no, totally. I like, we have the bandwidth for each other, and a lot of that requires, I think, in my view, probably a lot of people share this belief, but like continuously like creating your community around you. And of course, Radical Planners is a place that we do that. And some of the ways that you and I have deeply connected historically is like coming off of a call together and being like, can we debrief? Like, I'm feeling, you know, vulnerable, or I'm feeling like an emotional hangover. For me, I'm so much like, even in the most radical, most well-curated, safest, bravest spaces, I still find like, I want to find my people when I can, like when I am feeling some kind of way, especially like working remotely, coming off of a call and just sitting like alone in your room and being like, whoa, I am like, is that like intensely moving experience. And now it's like dead silent and there's like no one to like, you know, so I've felt really grateful for that. So thanks for the intention. And we're back. Yeah. This is his friend. She's got a little dreidel chew toy. Over here.
I love it. I love it. Are we in Hanukkah right now?
Yeah, we're just past it. Yeah. Just last week. So, but my mother, when she can't be around, she sends her toys in the mail. Aww. And so we got a chewy dreidel.
Which a doting grandmother. I love it.
Yeah, she is. She really is.
Well, let's talk about how you got into this work. Where did you start and how did you get here?
Yeah, great question. Long, winding road. So I studied jazz trumpet pedagogy in college. So naturally, I became a radical financial planner. Typical pipe. So it's so interesting, because I think so, like, you know, when I was, you know, I don't know how far back we go, I was born. So 1987. No, my folks, we came, you know, I came up like working lower middle class. I'm in the Midwest. My folks, both working class folks who have been working, you know, as a kid, 2-3 at a time. My dad owned his own business. My mom worked for him. That's where they met. And so my childhood was around sort of this like suburban working class experience that was a lot about class ascension. And like this, the mode to safety and comfort was like, was well. And there's a lot of stigma and a lot of stuff we can talk around there around like Jewish identity and sort of like what we were desiring. But I think ultimately, looking back on it, it was really about, yeah, safety and comfort. Like, these are things that we deserve too. And so since I was very young, like I became really good at golf. My dad like bartered for golf lessons when I was like 3 to like get me, you know, into this kind of elite sport that you wouldn't normally, you know, associate people who are socialized as women to play. And I got really good at it. And then coming into college, like, was meant to sort of like be a professional golfer and sort of like ascend class. and then much to my dad's chagrin, I became a music teacher. I play the trumpet. I've been, you know, kind of playing jazz for a long time. It's been like my passion, my thing that I wanted to do. Study jazz trumpet pedagogy, like double majored in music, like went in really hard, gave up the scholarships, took out student loans, did all the sort of like starving artist stuff. And I think in that, coming out of college, in that experience, I really realized like, oh, like the people who I see as most important in society and like so critical for setting culture and, you know, artists, culture workers, healers, like are the first to go and are the like very least paid and the very most overworked. And so I think I took that coming out of college because, I was going to like be a potentially a trumpet professor and I was going to make like $30,000 a year. And meanwhile, I'm watching people like become like executive assistants to paralegals at law firms and making like $70,000 in 2010. So anyway, long story short, I came out of that work and I was like, I'm going to just like, I don't want to do any of this. And basically took a vow of poverty and worked like a bunch of jobs as a barista, a bike shop, like maintenance dude, just like did a bunch of other jobs, worked for Apple for a while. And eventually one day I thought like, maybe I want, I partnered. So I got together with my now ex-wife. And one day I was like, I think I want this thing called health benefits. and how does one get health benefits? And so I, started kind of talking, asking around, seeing if there was like ways that I could like get a job as like an admin or something somewhere, and ended up actually getting a job at a registered investment advisory firm as an executive assistant. And that job, for better or for worse, was like the thing that springboarded me into this work and also gave me like a ton of knowledge that a lot of people don't have in the work of investment advisory, financial planning. It was like the thing that put me right in the middle of it. So like the short story of it is I became an executive assistant for a 72-year-old rich white dude who was like my mentor at the time. And 6 months in, he decided to, 6 months into my working there, he decided to divorce his third wife and remarry his first ex-wife, fell back in love, okay. Which is a journey that people go on apparently, but just felt very like rich white dude who owns an investment advisory firm. And so in that process, we sold the firm. And the reason this is an important piece of the story is I did a 10,000 point valuation of the business. I met every single client. I went through everybody's financial plans with them and I was the executive assistant. But basically because I was the person actually doing the work behind the sort of like, white CEO who had these relationships with people, I learned everything about how like an investment advisory firm works and everything about like, what are the important details to know about clients? Like, do they actually care about like these aspects of a financial plan and their Monte Carlo analysis? Or do they just want you to remember their like grandkid's name? Yeah. And so I got, I know. It was wild for me to kind of explore the fact that I was just like, as a person, able to like pay attention. And so, learn these details about people and then kind of like, be kind of beloved by them. And the way that our industry works is like they select you as a person, as an advisor, and then you kind of, they're stuck with you kind of, you become friends. And so anyway, fast forward, the firm was acquired and the acquiring firm was like, do you want to run this branch? And it was like, we managed $250 million and like we had like half of our business was retirement plan, half of it. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So I became like fast tracked from like executive
benefits. Yes.
Exactly. Health benefit. Right. Truly. Yeah. Looking back like a year and a half prior. And so just looking at the like very hierarchical workplace, like, looking at coming from executive assistant to like, being in the C-suite was like a weird, really weird experience for me.
And,
but also
let me pause you because I know for myself, when I was moving into financial services and like the industry has so much wealth, like it felt uncomfortable. Like my heritage is Mexican and I wasn't used to that. Like I grew up in a swap meet, right? And then it was really different. But I'm thinking right now, I wonder if the golf course made it easy for you.
Yes? Oh, 1,000%, 1,000%. Yes. And I think it's interesting. I didn't know you grew up in a swap meet. It makes sense. Your brain for like people and marketplace, that combination, but hadn't made that before. And I love it. The right kind of market. But yeah, no, 1,000%. Yeah. Golf. So I should be more specific. The golf aspect and the sort of other ways that I was kind of socialized into like understanding ways of wealth. My folks owned a flower shop, but like in Chicago, they owned a wedding business. So like I was around a lot of like rich, white, mostly Jewish families getting married in like downtown Chicago. And so I was around a lot of wealth. My dad did a lot, like we went golfing a lot. We went on these kind of like really like extravagant, you know, like little excursions. And usually it was like, we would find, like I said, my dad bartered for my golf lessons when I was a kid. Like it wasn't like we had the money to do these things, but yeah, those were the skills that were then transferable. And I was able to sort of like be on the golf course. People make a lot of jokes about like, you know, deals don't happen in the boardroom. They happen at the urinal. They also happen on the golf course. Cause I don't use a urinal as a trans guy. You can. I don't, but I was a very like golf necessary.
I love how you're answering. I had the question. I'm glad you answered it.
You never know. And there's a whole thing about bathrooms that we can go into that I won't go into right now, but no, like truly the golf was actually one of the, like, not just like the culture of golf, but really golf in general, like generally was like a thing that allowed me to get in with folks. Like I was able to take clients golfing, and that was like an afternoon. And just to like kind of not to beat a feed a fed horse here, but like my colleagues at this firm were mostly like middle-aged white women. And I came in as like a 26-year-old, like white masculine person, lesbian identified person. And I was very like shocked at how quickly I just moved beyond these women who'd been there, who actually had the knowledge, who actually had the relationships. And I think it really just prioritized dominant identities and like masculinity. And then also this other aspect of like of golf, where I was able to sort of come in on a work day, go take clients out golfing while everybody else was like on the phone with Schwab and like dealing with software and stuff. It was really a wild, yeah, wild exploration of kind of gender identities, even as somebody who was still pretty far from the center of the wheel of power and privilege as like a, you know, masculine, but like queer, you know, non-normative, non like cishet normative person. And golf really allowed me, I think, was one of the things that allowed me to sort of like go to the fun place that also is the place where like deals happen. And you build relationships, and people would like be like, yeah, we should just move our investment account to y'all. Like it would happen over the course of like getting personal with people. And I don't know, I have versions of that now, which are like, oh, go ahead.
And when did social justice come in? Because it doesn't sound like that firm was valuing the responsibility.
No, gosh, no. Really, No. The path, I mean, that was, I experienced, I think there was where I sort of experienced wealth hoarding. I experienced how easy it is to just drink the Kool-Aid of traditional financial advice. And, you know, the financial services industrial complex was sort of like, is like rife with just like plugging people into the system and being like, this is what we do. And lots of, you know, empirical evidence for why we do this, blah, blah, blah. When I kind of burned out at that firm and had some really harsh experiences with, the men in leadership, the cis men in leadership there. And I left, I actually went to Rachel and Maya at what was then Robichaudy and Philipson, now at Ascena Social Capital. And I'm really looking to them for like support, mentorship. I think I Googled like queer financial planning, and like Rachel and Maya popped up for their firm. Like wow. I think my ex-wife actually supported me in sort of finding like, yeah, are there people in this space doing like what I at the time knew as like socially responsible investing? And so anyway, went to their office, sat on their couch and cried and was just like, oh, like there are my people in this work. Like we do exist. I can't, you know, their couch was just apparently a place where people could come and sit and talk and learn. But like, it was like, for me, it was such a powerful moment to be like, oh, like we are here, and I can see myself in a way that I hadn't in this industry specifically at all. I'd like met like maybe like two women who were advisors, but beyond that, it was like, you know, and they worked at like Merrill Lynch. But beyond that, I knew that like we had to be somewhere, but I didn't know where. And anyway, so I got into Adesina and Robichaudy and Philipson. And then, you know, over the course of 2 years there, the pandemic hit. I started in March 2020. We all were working remotely and I was no longer traveling to San Francisco. And we sort of had this massive shift where we were like, oh, okay, this is like how we're going to manage this. And then George Floyd was murdered and the social justice uprisings of 2020. I think my politicization in social justice was not just at that moment, because I've been like, you know, a radical grouchy anarchist since I was like, but like as a as a person in this work and saying that I can make that there's a connection to be made between personal and professional. 2020, summer of 2020 was the time when I sort of learned like, oh, this is necessary inside the work of financial services. And actually like money is the tool that like is can be leveraged by movements, and we need to make this connection between movements and finance. And anyway, the kind of the rest is history after that. But that's how I got into making social justice a part of it, and actually just talking to hundreds of prospective clients and people in community, and being, you know, in deep community with folks in movement. And then fall of 2020 is when a bunch of us radical planners now, but you know, just people who are looking for community, comradeship, and like referrals, got together, six of us got together in 2020 to talk about like, how do we build sort of a wider network of people who are doing radical financial planning, helping people redistribute their wealth, divest and reinvest, that sort of thing.
Right. And you just celebrated 3 years. So that's, that's really.
Happy birthday, Rad Planners.
I know. I love that we had our astro chart read, right?
I know, literally, Vera. Astrological. Literally loved that so much. And I felt like it was such an identity, like it was very much a show and don't tell. Like, we're going to show you how Rad Planners operates. We're going to like demonstrate to you that actually what we do is we do like weird, cool, crazy things. We make connections between things that wouldn't like seemingly be connected. And I feel like that was one of the moments where, yeah, going through Rad Planner's chart and sort of like, what are we about? Give us also an opportunity to explore like, you know, Vera woven Marxism and communism and, you know, BDS. And it was a powerful experience. But yeah, rather than just sort of saying like, yeah, 3 years, what have we accomplished in 3 years? It was very much like, where are we now? We're not looking back or necessarily forward. It's very cool.
Or who have we become as a community?
Yeah, exactly. Right. How did we get here versus like, what are all the conditions that have been created? It was very much like, how are we showing up all together here today?
When we started talking about your childhood and money, you said that like class ascension was a big part of it. How do you see that impact you now, if at all? Like, do you feel like so how does class ascension work with you now?
Oh, great question. So something I didn't touch on in my experience in 2020, and some of the main support I had was from a colleague, Iris Brilliant, who's actually one of the original six people who started also Rad Planners, a money coach, works with folks with access to like, right now she's really working on like dynastic trusts and working with like family stakeholders, but really works with folks to redistribute their wealth and kind of unlearn a lot of like patterns of white supremacy culture. But she supported me in the process of like, so as all of these, you know, mostly like wealthy, rich kids, you know, 18 to 35-ish, were coming from Resource Generation and Solidaire and looking to like redistribute their wealth through Adesina, I had all this class rage coming up. I didn't have a name for it. I just was like, oh, I'm like I could barely deal with the like what you said, you know, being in this work and sort of identifying the like gap between myself and the ultra rich people I was supporting and the really wealthy folks that I was like helping build a financial plan and helping them hoard their wealth. But then the other side of this coin, which I think is like really powerful work, was like, okay, now I want to work with people who want to give away all their money. Like, you're like, you know, I was having all this stuff of like, I would meet with a like young person who had been sort of indoctrinated into like elite whiteness basically through their wealth and through their family, and they would just be kind of helpless in my experience. Like, as my class rage, I would view them as like, you're helpless, you're totally like, you want to give all this money away, you don't even pay your own phone bill. Like, it was a lot of judgment. And Iris really worked with me and sat with me, bless her heart, like sat with me for a full afternoon one day and was just sort of like, these are all actually the privileges of, or all the patterns of class privilege. And here are the ways actually that those things are showing up. And if you can support people and you can like, you know, be with your class rage, but also like hold the fact that these folks are like humans and people who like are on a journey, then we can actually move some money. Like, we can help people actually move money outside out of their like, you know, $10 million trust, you know, for movement. So that was a powerful, I think, you know, so speaking of like class ascension, my getting in right relationship and like my class consciousness for myself and sort of seeing how I was showing up with folks and then supporting people actually to be like, hey, I want to be a class traitor. Like, I actually don't want this and I want to stop ignoring it and I can't ignore it any longer. But also like, I need help with like my dad, my uncle, my mom, my trust, my estate planning attorney, my CPA, like all these people who are sort of like embedded in the patchwork of white supremacy, but also like, just like class privilege. Yeah. It was really a powerful moment to name and acknowledge that for myself and then be able to go to like, okay, and how can I actually show up a little bit differently in order to do what I'm setting out to do with people and see people and like offer them love. Cause truly they're like really radical people who wanted to, but who had like maybe never applied for a job before. You know, and that was something I'd never done as a financial planner, being like, oh, I'm looking through your plan and you need a job. You know, like if you want to do what you want to do, which is like give away all your money or, you know, redistribute over a period of time, like you need to do some of these things that I actually felt like I had a lot of experience with as a working class person. So I felt like I was maybe the right person to be there, but needed to get over some of my stuff.
Yeah. And I think what you said, right, you said something beautiful about like, I needed to see them. Right? Mm-hmm. Like see them outside of the distress of oppression. There's a group that I work with called Be Present. Tiffany Brown, mm-hmm. She's part of Cordata.
Yeah, so. I've heard of Be Present, but I haven't ever been to any of their stuff or gotten into any of their work. I know there's lots of folks in like community and stuff that do Be Present. So
Be Present, I'm connected to them through Wisdom and Money, which specifically works with people from a culture of wealth to see money as a place for transformation. And the thing that they brought in Be Present about 20 years ago because they were like, we're working with people with so much privilege and we kept hitting up on all of these things. They kept hitting up on like race and like they didn't have the tools for it, right? Because these are people, this is like a support group for people of wealth, like white people of wealth. And they didn't, they recognized that they're like, we keep tripping over the same stone.
Yeah.
What Be Present does is like it teaches you, and it takes a long time, I think it takes a long time to see people outside of the distress of oppression. And I know that my personal experience and recovery work and like the 12 steps and seeing and connecting with people across all kinds of different identities then made it possible. But I know when I talk to people about the work that I do at Strategy Squad, where we help people redistribute, they're always, their mouth just drops, right? Because it does feel like they're at the goal and they're quitting. They're like, they have more money than they know what to do with and they're trying to get rid of it. Like how, it just puts capitalism on its head.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Yeah,
I love that. I'm going to definitely look. Thanks. I feel like, you know, I have this like rule of like, if like three people tell me about a thing, I need to go deep, like dive deeper into it. So I'm hearing Be Present and it feels like a good calling to go check out more. So thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got some beautiful tools. So you are anti-capitalist, abolitionist, vegan, feminist, activist, non-Zionist, anarcho-utopianist.
Mm-hmm.
What is anarcho-utopianist?
I love it so much. So I think like, you know, I've been in, of course, anarchy spaces for many years and lots of early days organizing with like Food Not Bombs as an anarchist, sort of like, before I even really knew much of my queer, trans, like radical, radically different, non-normative identity about myself, I identified as sort of like, the government is screwed up. I don't know. I was going to drop the F-bomb. Anyway, the structures and the systems that we have are deeply oppressive. And I want to like, you know, tear it down, eat the rich. And I still believe that as an anarchist, I still believe that we like need to resist and we do need to like, you know, topple the structures that exist. But I had this experience in anarchy, which I think is probably comes up against my like Jewish identity around like hope. Like I felt like I couldn't show up in anarchy as like a joyful, hopeful person. Felt like I had to sort of be negative all the time. And I don't think that that's the case. I just think that like it's really depressing to really look and turn to see the systems as they are. And so when I found this community of folks, like mostly in, you know, queer theory and like utopianist people who are picturing, you know, Afrofuturists, like people who are picturing a future that is more utopian, you know, as a sort of a place to get to on the map. I was like, oh, actually, the blend of like anarchy and utopianism together are sort of like, is the anarchy that I am sort of, you know, feel more identified with. And then I had a friend be like, yeah, that's anarcho-utopianism. It's a thing. It like exists. I was like, oh, okay, cool. So for the most part, it's just this idea for me that like, I think, and also the stigma of anarchy is so much, right? Like what the right and what, you know, the dominant culture would have us believe about anarchy is just like, we're just like burning it down and there's sort of like nothing to rebuild versus like, actually it is just another version of resist and build. And we want to build the world that we want that is, you know, for people, by people versus just some structures that have been oppressed on us. And utopia, it can be a vision of where we're going and feels very hopeful. And like, as close as we get to it is fine for me. So that's like the idea that anarchy is building a new thing versus just the focus of tearing it down to like stigmatize and make it really a negative identity is the combination.
Okay. Yeah. Cause it feels like such a contradiction, anarchy and utopia. And yet it's like resist and build.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Such a beautiful framework that Rad Planners has taught me. And Can we talk about the process of Rad Planners deciding to say to like be in solidarity with Palestine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I know where you're going with this, so I'll speak to it, but feel free to, you know, add in just because we co-created that process together. But so yeah, as you know, as I think listeners will likely know, October 7th until today, there's been a violent and egregious attack on occupied Palestine, which has been occupied for 75 years and is not new, but has been a responsive genocide of Palestinian people, mainly in Gaza and the West Bank. And we, inside of Radical Planners, as people who do a lot of work to build community and hold each other and support each other in the work, I think have not necessarily been faced with some like current events since maybe 2020 with like what actually do we stand for. And in 2020, like the reason that we came together in October 2020 was on the heels of the murder of George Floyd. And so I think in that time, over the course of time, we've like literally, we are like a pandemic puppy in Rad Planners. We like really, you know, have grown out of this like space of like learning to be with one another in this like pandemic, you know, a post-pandemic world. Anyway, I think it coming into like, what does a community like ours do around something that is a deep politicized and like imperialist white supremacist issue, for lack of a better word, you know, conflict is used, but like, I think the issue of Israel's attack on Palestine and sort of like folks calling for a ceasefire, myself included, and specifically like politicizing and moving American Jews in this moment. Rad Planners is a space where like we've already built the framework. We've already been like, we're already standing on the foundation of a just transition and restorative economies and like, you know, solidarity economy. But it really was a moment for us to think about, I think, around like, do we have capacity to hold, like saying this thing, making a statement, being in solidarity with Palestinians in this moment? And so, Deanna, I appreciated you, you know, raising, like bringing to the group, to the steering crew. So, you know, I'll speak.
I raised it with saying, I don't think we can. Right. My initial reaction was, I'm scared. I don't think we can. I don't think we have the bandwidth for it. And I was really, and a lot of the times, like, and there wasn't, the conflict can create more strength and relationships. Mm-hmm. So during that week, during those 10 days, where as the steering crew of Rad Planners, we were negotiating this and having conversations around this, it was a growth moment for us. And I remember at one point thinking like, well, why didn't we say anything when Ukraine was invaded? And then I remembered, oh, because there was no steering crew. You know, there was like, it was like three people. Yeah. it was just a different version of it. And now here we are setting a pattern of like, I mean, the way that wealth is set up right now, the way that capitalism continues to be an outgrowth of colonialism. Like, I'm sure that we could spend all of our time trying to change the International Monetary Fund, right? Because the IMF continues to like, it's the way that colonization happens now. And I think of like, I think of my own experience. I live in Mexico City, and like the violence that we have in Mexico and how that's affected by just the repercussions of so much wealth being extracted. And one of my very, very close friends is Palestinian, and she works in Build Palestine. And I remember reaching out to her before we had this conversation at Rad Planners and telling her, like, talking about like my great grandparents were in Mexico when the U.S. was taking parts of Mexico. Right. So I there's stories in my family of like how people were killed during that, and just thinking like, wow, in 5-6 generations, this will be what's the stories will be in Palestine, of like if Palestine is completely absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the pain of like history repeating itself. And just like the helplessness that came over me, like that's where I was responding. Where like, we can't respond to this. And here you were at Rad Planners being like, we have to.
Oh, I so appreciate, I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, yes. And I appreciate your like, you know, your reflection on your take on it, because it, you know, one of the things that I don't know that I could have done that 3 years ago. I don't know that I could have done that, like, you know, two or a year ago. Like, I think so much of the sort of like current politicization and naming the other things in the room, like the fact that I am in deep community with organizers, that I am showing up and to acts of civil disobedience and getting arrested and experiencing the injustice like firsthand, and being in the and being politicized also as an American Jew. So also like to bring in the room the fact that like, you know, in the pillars of like of why Israel exists and is able to sort of do what Israel is doing right now, an act of genocide on Palestinians, and like just pretty much just cover up for settler colonialism and land grab, like you were saying. And I love the drawing the connections between that and Mexico and indigenous folks, and thinking about actually one of the reasons why this is so critical right now is that it's on a very shortened time frame. Like it is like one generation. Yeah. You can talk to folks like Palestinian folks who are like, yeah, I have family or like connections with folks to like a pre-occupied Palestine, which is, yeah, anyway, there's a lot of history to go into there, but just like speaking from my own experience, what I was able to bring to the space, two reasons I was able to bring that. One is because I've been in political spaces of political education. So it's not, a lot of these connections to like also as an American Jew and being someone who's like, what is our role here? You know, what is our role as like, you know, meanwhile, I grew up, you know, hearing from everyone like in family and sort of extended family, like a land without people for a people without land. You know, this sort of like weaponizing Jewish trauma and grief in order to justify a land grab of Palestinian, you know, land that's been inhabited by Palestinians, and completely erasing people of color and the experience that I hear from indigenous folks here in California and the US. And like, of course, I'm sure is the experience of your family with connections to versions of genocide over land. So I was able to bring that because of so much of the political education that I've been a part of. But then the other piece that was really necessary was like actually having a space to be able to be emotionally vulnerable was so critical, because I was holding so much of that work. I think holding so much of it as sort of like, I'm doing this work, I'm in this work, like I'm so personally accountable, but like you raising it and having a steering crew, just thinking back like a couple of years ago before we had a steering crew, before I was like, oh, we need to depower me. I'm like the person that is like, you know, doing the calendar invites, and somehow all of this concentrated power inside of Radical Planners. And so developing a steering crew is so critical, because then I was able to come to this space and say like, okay, y'all, like I have feelings. And that was meant to be like a 10-minute experience of like, let's talk about maybe doing a thing, to like, it turned into like a 45-minute discussion. Everybody stayed over late. Y'all listened to me, held me. I sort of had a reactionary sort of, no, I don't think it was like deeply reactional, but it was definitely like a, oh, I'm having feelings about this.
You were exhausted too.
Yeah,
I was exhausted. Physically exhausted coming in from like physical, yeah, I remember. And it was... it was just such a moment of the quote that keeps coming to me right now is from bell hooks, and I forget what the book is, but she wrote, healing is an act of communion. Rarely if ever are any of us healed in isolation. Especially when the wound is relational, the healing, the medicine for it also needs to be relational.
I love that. Oh my gosh, I stand bell hooks. Yeah, I definitely in that moment, probably, and I think a big part of healing and like I said, kind of in the beginning, feeling like grief and rage and joy all at once, and hope. I think in that moment, I probably could have suppressed my feelings more. I was exhausted and also had been in community with folks taking the Oakland Federal Building overnight and had been detained by the police. There was a lot happening. And then the next morning coming into Rad Planners and having this conversation, it felt like it was also powerful. I probably historically would have just buried those feelings down. I probably would have been okay, we don't need to take a stance. You're right. We probably don't have the capacity for and even just saying take a stance, we don't even need to just sort of state our values, which were clear to all of us. But it was more I think a moment of a statement of solidarity isn't just to sort of say to wave the flag of this is what we stand for. But it's also really a moment to sort of declare y'all are we're safe. You're safe here. This is what we're about. It's clarifying over time, I think, to sort of say these are our commitments. This is our framework, but it's not just lip service. Here's how we actually show up in solidarity. Here are the moments when we actually show up in solidarity. And so I feel like it was because we were in the conversation, we were able to then kind of go, and then I just flowed. Then the stuff just came out of me and I wrote this long thing that we all co-created and snipped and put out together. But I felt like that was the moment. So you saying I'm really not sure, but I want to bring it to this group. I don't know, was a thing that really opened, cracked open for me. Oh yeah, I do think we should do this thing, which, on the heels of that has been so much beautiful. I'm just quickly to say that we had a Jewish affinity group last week where we had a bunch of, 10 of us American Jews inside of Rad Planners come together, and people I hadn't even known had Jewish identities came in the room, and we have a Slack channel now. And so it's a very powerful moment to also find our people inside of our groups, which I know you had some experience with the BIPOC group that came out of Rad Planners, out of somebody saying hey, there's maybe a need for this space. Yeah. So
as people who work in the financial services industrial complex, even if we don't hold a ton of wealth, we have access to people who do, right? Yeah. And we are we're thought partners, we're thought leaders. Us being well resourced to have these geopolitical conversations, which I honestly have always hid from. I've always been war, get me. I'm a Quaker, for God's sake. We're a pacifist. When I found Quakers, I was I've always been a Quaker. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
So it just current events for me have always, and I think that's also part of being an HSB, current events have always been so overwhelming that being in Rad Planners, being in our community, being with people who have done so much work to create safety makes it possible for me to go into it. Right. Yeah. And it's been such a lovely experience. It really is Rad Planners gives me hope to stay in this industry, because the financial services industry is insurance started from insuring enslaved cargo ships. Our roots are so dark.
Wow. Yeah. Great point. Yeah, they're really dark. They're why do we exist? It's a plantation metaphor. Yeah. Yeah.
Where I worked before, there were conversations that I was having that really literally asked me to leave all of my identities, leave all of my ancestors outside the door, come inside, and then help these people recreate systems that were harming me, harming people that are any generations that I may have, and just to work. Yeah. So it is deeply healing to be in Rad Planners.
I love that.
So thank you for being part of what made it possible and continuing to be such a key pillar of it.
Yeah. Thanks so much. I think as I'm hearing you say, finding your people and, and I think also asking the questions, like something I've experienced you do inside of Rad Planners is bringing questions that you hear to the group. Like you're like not, you're not centering yourself. You're like decentralizing power. You're like, you don't know, distributing it and sort of saying like, hey, here's a question. I could have an answer for it, but I think we should all talk about it. It's a great also, you know, I think microcosm of the bigger reason why like Rad Planners exists and why like communities are so critical. Just like asking the question, like how we got to Rad Planners was, should we have a group of people come together and like talk about like, how can we address this question together? And I think part of that is really healing in community. We were all kind of trying to heal in our silos and being like way over. So I think they'd like, you know, encouragement, the movement encouragement from that for me is like, yeah, just keep asking questions and then start asking other people about it. Even if it feels like overwhelming from whatever chair you're in. I think so many people have even found Rad Planners by talking about like, is there a community where like people can go to kind of process some of this like stuff that's coming up for them as like gatekeepers to wealth, or like you said, access to power and privilege. So yeah, I feel very grateful to be among my people asking questions kind of constantly and not assuming that we have the answers, but doing lots of question asking. And then usually like somewhere in the room, somebody has an answer or like a way to help you get there.
Or we come to it together, because that was one of the things that I've also been learning about white supremacy is like, or like the focus on individualism, right? Like there is an individual, there is a savior who will come to, oh my God, there's this song by Fantastic Negrito. I think it's from Oakland. And he talks about like, we all need a savior so we have someone to blame. And like the idea that there's going to be an individual who is going to come and fix it.
Right.
Puts like makes it so that I have absolutely like I don't have any responsibility because I'm not the savior. Right. I can just peace out and be like, it's not part of my thing. And yet what we really need to come to is like collectives need to be the ones that answer these questions. And there's a quote by Reverend Andrew Kyoto Williams that I probably am going to say in every single podcast. But without inner change, there can be no outer change. Oof. Without collective change, no change matters. Collective change, without us realizing how we're hurting each other or how we can help each other, without us being like, oh, you know what, health benefits for everyone, right. Like everyone gets health benefits,
right?
You know, like right. Everyone should have food and water.
Yeah, right. Some basics. I feel that really resonates with me around, you know, in individual versus collective. And there's a whole other probably podcast that I can speak to, like abolish the family and the nuclear family and the ways that we like, you know, white supremacy culture and the dominant culture builds these little silos to concentrate and enclose power and private property in the ways that all of that is related. But I think to your point about saviorism, like, there's also this aspect of, and especially like, you know, looking at, you know, Israel and occupied Palestine, like the way that there was such a weaponizing of grief and weaponizing of all of also the saviorism, like the ways that like Great Britain can and the US can sort of like on the heels of the Holocaust be like, it erase the fact that we were like complicit in the genocide of Jews in the Holocaust, and the ways that we can like just kind of brush over it by being like, we came in and we saved you against the, you know, the opposition, which, you know, has, I think, historically like looked just like Germany. And especially speaking with so many Germans, it's sort of like, no, actually, like not like the Nazi project was like a specifically like chaotic and also controlled like environment that was created by white supremacy. And like actually Great Britain and the US had a lot to do with it. Yeah. And the sort of, but the idea of white saviorism is just like, we can come in and fix it, just like philanthropy. Like, actually, don't you realize you're a massive part of the problem? But if you can come in and you can like save people, it erases the fact that you have been a part of like a massive part of the problem.
Yeah. Like I remember when I read this book ages ago, I think it was called The Tools of Titan or something. And it was Titans of Finance. And it talked about Weimar's Republic in Germany. I think I'm butchering his name. And it talked about how finance created, like there was so much deflation that people in Germany were like pushing buckets of cash to buy a loaf of bread. And there was just like starvation and hunger. And this made it possible for Nazism to really, really take hold and for it to be like democratically elected. Right? And it was that idea of like, we've got to blame someone.
Right.
And moving away from that human desire to have someone to blame it takes acknowledging our own complicity in it. And like, I realized that when I moved to Philadelphia at 32, I didn't know my skin was white until then. Like I grew up in Southern California where everybody that looked like me was Mexican. And then I didn't know how it had protected me until I spoke with other Mexican Americans who were slightly darker than me, like my mom or my brother.
Whoa.
And heard their experience. And right. That's when, like, seeing how I had benefited from it made it possible for me to start questioning it, right? And just, yes. it gave me a new lens to see. And it's so painful.
Yeah.
Right? Oof. Yeah.
It is so painful. It's so, it's hard to know, especially the ways. And I see this and have so much compassion and empathy for other folks and also myself included, for like white fragility around, or just fragility in general around like implicit power that is like given over to us as dominant folks, like, you know, us being like anyone with dominant identities. I think this is specifically like came up for me around like what I shared around being a masculine person inside of a firm and suddenly sort of given a lot of privilege and my brain trying to make sense and trying to be like, I must be smarter. I must be better. I must be like, I must have it more together versus like, oh no, actually like you're given this privilege because you have this identity that is privileged, or you have nepotism. Like there's many different ways that, you know, that I think people we can try and justify our privilege. And just hearing about your experience as someone who like in a community had like less privilege or more privilege based on your demographic reminds me of like being in spaces before I understood some of my identities and thinking about like, actually, I do have like a lot of privilege here and how afraid I was, how painful it was to really feel that. Because I think what it did was it really like ripped the wool off my eyes. It was really like, oh, there's like always power dynamics here. And there's always, you know, I'm walking down the street with trans friends and being like, oh, I'm now experiencing how society views you and versus like how I would view and be in like one-to-one conversation. So like, I really think it blew the lid off for me to really start recognizing privilege as a white person, as a masculine person, which is complex because then you're just like, dude, but I'm so marginalized, you know, like in my heart, I'm just like, oh, I'm so othered in society, even more so than marginalized. But the ways that I have like the difference between like power, privilege, and positionality is that I can like, you know, when I've dated like people of color or something, like walking through a Walgreens, the way that I wouldn't be followed around, but that maybe like my like black queer femme girlfriend would, you know, it's a very interesting thing to be in community with. So,
yeah. So for any people who are highly sensitive working in finance, how do you, like, where do you go when you're overwhelmed? What's your refuge?
That's a really great question. I think this is evolving and sort of like actually really up for me these days. So it's a good question for me to sit with and for us to end with. Especially inside of finance, I think there's so much gaslighting. I don't even know if it's gaslighting necessarily, but so much like kind of crazy making where you feel, you know, like I don't know how it's like societal gaslighting inside of so many rooms, at conferences, in client meeting, when you're sitting down with an attorney, with someone who like, you know, is sort of like, you know, like I said, chug the Kool-Aid of white supremacy culture. And so I find like the times when I'm most overwhelmed to be not just like when there's a lot of inputs, but when there's inputs that are sort of like directly in opposition to how I feel or what my beliefs are, but I don't really have the space or time or whatever energy, I haven't thought about it and prepared in order to have like a response or like move people. And so I think where my refuge lately has been in like organizing around the build. What are the systems we're building? And I think a big part of that is like tapping out of the resistance for a while. I think I really was in resist for a long time, which can be, I think we like, everyone is needed in the resistance and in the revolution. And I think like some people spend more time there and then work in the build side. And I think these days I'm more called to like building new structures, but not in a way that like erases the necessity for the people inside of the resist. I'm like, thank you for doing some of the resist work. It just was really exhausting. And so I think that my resourcing is so much about reading and normalizing my experience. I'm reading a lot of queer theory. I'm reading a lot of abolition work and disability justice frameworks and understand, like people who've imagined a different world, who've like, you know, I'm reading a book called Surviving the Future right now, which is like a book about, you know, abolishing like carceral systems in the state, but also has such an intertwined, narrative of just having to imagine those futures to begin with. And so like sitting with a lot of those, dreams and beliefs that feel sometimes really hopeless, or when I'm sitting in a meeting with somebody and they're just like, that's not the way the world is. It's oftentimes white cis men, but anyone, right? Like there are lots of people who will be like, oh, this is how it is. They're saying facts. So one of the ways that I'm trying to normalize for myself is to read and learn and find more of my people, have more of these conversations. And then the other piece, I think that the addition to that is like, I think what you said in the beginning, finding people who have bandwidth for me and I have bandwidth for them. In those moments, I don't necessarily need to say like, hey, Steve, like, I feel defensive. Like I just, and then knowing that he's not going to hold my feelings. Right. He's not going to hear me. We're not going to have an emotional process, but going outside of the circle, processing with my people, and then potentially having, I had an experience recently, which I just share like a little bit about without identifying who this person is. But, I experienced like being asked to work on a project with someone who is, on the heels of October 7th in Israel occupied Palestine, who specifically was coming at women of color on the internet for their positions on Palestine, on a free Palestine. And he's a funder. He like represents a funder. He works at a firm, is a managing director. And I had to walk away from work with him, but I had this really meaningful like internal process. It took me to get there. So I think therapy, friends, I talked and processed to people who were really close to me. I talked a lot about it in therapy. And I think so much of what came up for me was like imposter syndrome and maybe I can move this guy. Maybe it's like my work to, move this guy along. And then really being like, no, he's like an Israeli person who's like deeply traumatized, who's acting out his trauma in community. And like, I don't need to be the person. Like, that's a lot of my codependency work is like, I'm powerless over other people, but how do I help people move? That wasn't my work. And to get there, it took me like 3 weeks of like sitting with myself, processing, moving slowly and sitting with my thoughts. So I think a big part of that, my other part of that answer is like therapy, having spaces that are safe for me to explore some of how I felt, because I could not figure out what I was feeling. I was just like, was getting like major imposter syndrome as a young person in this work, wanting to be perfect, not wanting to like make anyone, being like, wow, this radical person like has deeply like opposite views of me and he could control the narrative. Like, and then he's also a funder. I work on projects that he funds. He could cut our funding. Like it was a big power dynamic dance, and finally got to the other side of it, talking to lots of friends.
Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, we just have to give ourselves the time and space, like until it's clear, do nothing. That was one of the things that I learned when I was in Al-Anon. Like, if you're not sure what to do, just wait. Right. Like, exactly. It will eventually become clear. So letting go of urgency. Right.
Yeah. And I think the thing with urgency and waiting is like the intentional waiting versus the avoiding is something for me to clarify. Like, I would be like, oh, I'm waiting, or I'm just waiting for like the stars to align, versus like, I'm intentionally waiting. I'm intentionally not doing anything in order to give myself the opportunity to, I think in financial services, we tell so many people like after a big life event, don't make any decisions. Don't like, if somebody dies, don't like act out of grief. But also, how do we use those moments as like springboards to action? How do we support people to say like, intentionally wait, intentionally choose a time when you're going to move toward this? And then we can be there to, support them through that process, which is, I think, a blessing as a financial advisor to be able to help people through that.
Yeah. I often tell people like it is an honor to get to do the money work with people, because it's so private and it touches so many things, whether you're highly sensitive or not. Like there are so many connections with your money and everything around you. Leo, it's been such a pleasure to get to have a conversation with you. I'm so excited to share this with others. Mm-hmm. And thank you. Thank you for all the work that you've done and for showing up here so vibrantly.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. And yeah, I definitely like, as people are exploring this, you know, of course we have Rad Planners. I'm sure you'll post some things about and ways for people to get in touch, you know, can definitely reach out to us there and join and sort of like talk about different ways into this work or ways to find our people here. But if they found you already, then they're finding their way. So
thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Jenna. Hope you have a great day. Take care.
Bye. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Diana Giselle Yanez. Did you enjoy this episode? Please share this first season of Highly Sensitive Money with others. To learn how you can upskill your money relationship, join the newsletter over at allthecolors.net. That's allthecolors.net for network. Take care, and remember, you've got what it takes to feel good about your money.